Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. We've got a great conversation about faithful family life, looking at things through that with that Lutheran worldview. We've been talking about college quite a bit lately. We're going to continue our conversation about colleges today. Academic freedom, religious freedom. Where do they overlap? Do they come from the same place? We're going to talk about that here in just a little bit. Thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin, for supporting this program. To find out more about Concordia University, Wisconsin, go to our website, kfuo.org. And there you can find the sponsor section. Look for CUW, Concordia University, Wisconsin, in the sponsor section there. And you can find out more about them, where they're located, all the programs they have to offer. Go check it out, kfuo.org. Look for CUW in the sponsor section. Well, for our conversation today about academic freedom and religious freedom, we have two guests. Joining us by phone today, Dr. Gene Veith, Provost at Patrick Henry College. Good morning, Dr. Veith. Thanks so much for taking some time to talk with us today about academic freedom and religious freedom. Looking forward to the conversation.
Well, I'm glad to be part of it.
Also joining us in studio today are the Reverend Dr. Paul Philp, Director of Institutional Integrity and Research for Concordia University System. Dr. Philp, welcome back to Faith and Family.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, both of you have been guests on Faith and Family, so you know how this goes. We just have a good old conversation. We have a lot of fun. And today we're talking about academic freedom, so no fun with that.
No fun at all. No.
Dr. Veith, tell us about your work there. Tell us about Patrick Henry College and the work that you do there as provost.
Well, Patrick Henry College grew out of the homeschool movement, actually, for a place where kind of some of the best and the brightest homeschool kids could come to really build on their foundation and take them further. We have what we call a classical Christian liberal arts curriculum that's very rigorous. We get really good students. We give them a top-notch education. Our students score at our average score for our graduates is the highest on the ETS proficiency profile. That's the equivalent of the SAT for college students. We have some of the highest scores. So we're trying to do higher education right. And we're having quite a bit of success in the kind of students we turn out.
And what does academic freedom mean at a college like Patrick Henry College?
Well, academic freedom is the principle that professors can have wide latitude in teaching and in their scholarship. The idea for the accumulation of knowledge, scholars need to be free to pursue ideas wherever it leads them. And when you try to control that and restrict what they can study or so on, that thwarts the process of the growth of knowledge. So, but in Christian schools, we also have academic freedom, but faculty members agree to sign a statement of faith, and this varies from school to school, tradition to tradition, and that's been done since the earliest times. Oxford and Cambridge for centuries operated with a statement of faith. Not just faculty, but students had to agree to the 39 principles of the 39 articles of the Church of England and so on. But so academic freedom exists even with a commitment to the position of the college. In other words, colleges themselves have academic freedom to uphold the teachings of their church or the theological tradition that they identify with, and that's an expression of academic freedom. You know, to say that you can't have statements of faith, or the Christians can't commit to the teachings of the church that sponsors the institution, to me that itself is a violation of academic freedom. It's telling academics and colleges of what they cannot believe and what they cannot do. So in most Christian schools, ones that are really committed to some kind of biblical truth, academic freedom does apply in what professors do in the classroom and the kinds of things that they pursue. But if they should ever decide that they no longer believe the things that they said they believed in when they first joined the faculty, there are plenty of other places that they can go and follow their scholarly interest. But academic freedom as an educational kind of tool certainly exists within Christian schools and by Christian faculty members.
Dr. Philip, having served at Concordia Seminary, now Concordia University System, where does academic freedom fit into the especially the Christian liberal arts education that students receive at a Concordia University? Where does academic freedom fit into this picture of Concordia Universities?
Well, it fits in the overarching nature of the programs of study. I think it's important to distinguish between what is allowed under academic freedom mm-hmm. and what's required, in a sense. The allowance is that there's room for, as Dr. Veith indicated, research and even teaching about a wide variety of things. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to require all of those things to be addressed in a particular area. So within a given context of an individual institution or a liberal arts education, the faculty in designing its curriculum is going to determine what are we going to mm-hmm. include, what are we not going to include. And academic freedom gives them the ability to make those determinations. So within the context of a Christian liberal arts institution like a Concordia University, as they're making those decisions, part of what they're going to elect to include is what we as Christians and specifically as Lutherans in the Concordia system believe, teach, and confess mm-hmm. about particular things. That doesn't mean they're going to exclude teaching what others outside of our mm-hmm. context believe and teach about those things. But they're going to present that within a Christian context and with the worldview that's framed by that context.
Academic freedom seems to be a bigger issue among institutions of higher education. It doesn't seem to be as big of a concern among primary education and secondary, the elementary schools, grade schools, and high schools. It doesn't seem to be as big of an issue there because it's becoming an issue with things like Common Core and things like mm-hmm. that. Questions are coming up. Shouldn't we have the freedom to teach what we believe? Shouldn't we have the freedom to teach what we want to teach? Why is this so important to institutions of higher education? Why is academic freedom so important for colleges and universities? Dr. Veith?
Well, colleges and universities are not just teaching institutions. A lot of colleges are. That's our specialty. Uh-huh. And that's true in the Concordias. That's true where I am right now, although I spent many years also teaching in the Concordia system at Concordia Mequon, your sponsor. Mm-hmm. But today, universities are the source of new knowledge. That's where scientific breakthroughs are taking place. That's where scientists work. That's where new technology is formed. And so it's the role of the universities as knowledge kind of creators or knowledge discoverers or inventors that really academic freedom came about and is such an emphasis. And it has to do not so much with teaching, but with the development of research, so that people would, so that scholars would, mm-hmm. scientists would have a free hand to pursue things wherever it leads. Now, high schools and primary schools and grammar schools and so on, they don't have that function, and so typically the curriculum is sort of laid out by the authorities or whoever is doing that, the school board or the teachers themselves get together and settle on the curriculum, and so that's what they typically go with. But universities today are seen sort of as the source of new knowledge, as well as having a teaching function. So that's why it's become a bigger issue in higher education, and it's a fairly new concept. It really grew out of the it became a big issue sort of in the Cold War era of the 40s and the 50s, when some state institutions were worried about communism and shall we have loyalty oaths to make sure that the faculty isn't communist or hasn't been infiltrated by communism. And there was a big resistance about that, the attempt of the government originally to control what's allowed to be taught or allowed to be said in the university context. So a lot of the kind of academic freedom has sort of been the professor's impulse to sort of protect themselves originally against sort of government intrusion into what they're allowed to do or to believe.
So academic freedom allows for institutions of higher education it really allows for opportunities to research in areas that haven't really been explored enough, where we want to learn more, where we want to do research. Having academic freedom allows us to investigate, to explore more, rather than just teaching the same thing over and over again. Not that there's anything wrong with teaching the same thing, but it gives us the freedom, the kind of an open door to investigate in areas that need investigating. Dr. Phil, any thoughts on why academic freedom is important?
Yeah, picking up on that same thing, in order for that investigation to take place within the academy of the experts in a particular field, they need the freedom to be able to discuss what they're finding with their colleagues, to share ideas and to compare research. And so that aspect of academic freedom and being able to publish findings, even if they may be somewhat disturbing or somewhat controversial, that becomes an important part of that investigative and research process. It allows for that dialogue to take place. It allows for those who may be coming to a particular activity or particular topic from a different viewpoint to be able to engage that topic in an academic debate kind of a sense, so that both parties are able to refine their thinking and to come to an understanding of a clear picture of what's going on. So that becomes an important aspect then that then does ultimately carry over into that teaching role as well. As the faculty members who are engaged in that research are learning new things or discovering new things, that knowledge is being shared with their students, not just for the purpose of passing on the knowledge, but also teaching those students to be able to do those same kinds of things in research. And that really becomes a key part of preparing them for whatever their life of service is going to be after they leave that institution of higher education. There's a window of time that they're there. There's certainly a component of knowledge that is passed on during that time in terms of facts and things of that nature that those students will draw upon. But more importantly, they're being formed for the rest of their life in whatever aspect of the world they're going to be living in and having their being and whatever type of work they're going to be doing. And that formation is fundamentally undergirded by the ability for them to understand how do you look at the world that you live in? How do you research what's going on? And how do you understand what new things may emerge and discover new things? And that'll be important for those students if they're going to be able to, have a successful post-college life in order to be able to interact with the world around them.
That was a pretty Lutheran answer. The basically, you're saying that college is this formative time that that prepares them for a future vocation. And so everything that goes into college really shapes how they're going to perceive the world in the future and what they're going to do with that future vocation. Is that a fair summary?
Certainly, there's a.
What are some misconceptions about academic freedom?
Well, let me bring in another Lutheran perspective on this, and it does deal with misconceptions of academic freedom. Some people think that, say, a Christian institution, the Christianity, you know, controls and determines everything that's said and done to the point of eliminating any kind of objective study of anything. Everything has to be Christianized in a sense. Now, I think that's very unfair criticism of Christian colleges as I've known them, and yet there is a certain theology where that can become an issue. I mean, there is the belief among some Christians, the sort of one kingdom theology, that there's a distinct Christian approach to geology and art and literature and business and every field. There has to be a specific kind of Christian content to it that's different from the content of the way a non-Christian would approach those same fields.
Mm-hmm.
As Lutherans, we have this doctrine of the two kingdoms, which teaches that God rules in the spiritual kingdom through his word and through the church, but he also rules through in a hidden way in all the world, in the secular realm too. He's in control of that. And what that means for Lutheran scholars is that the secular world too, so called, is also falls under God's domain, but that we can learn about that through reason and through investigation and through research, and that when we're studying and learning something in the sciences or in social sciences or in the humanities or the arts, that whatever we discover is part of what God has made. It's part of His creation. But that we don't have to kind of artificially make it Christianize. It's already part of God's kingdom. And so for Christian scholars who understand that, that gives incredible freedom. I mean, we have freedom in the gospel, certainly, in the spiritual kingdom. But there is freedom in the way we live and interact in the secular world. Now, the two kingdoms does not mean that just anything and everything goes, because God rules the whole world, even those who don't know Him, through His moral law, through the natural laws that He's built into creation. And so the things that we learn and our interactions in the public square, we're still bound to follow God's moral law as much as we can. You know, the first use of the law, in particular, what God uses to sort of restrain evil. And so Christian scholars need to express their faith in the way they live and in the things they study and the approach that they take and in the way they treat people, above all, the way they treat their neighbor. But Christians have, again, a vocation, and some Christians have a vocation to be scientists or to be artists or to be philosophers or to be political scientists or whatever it is. They have vocations to be scholars, and so they can follow their calling in the knowledge that God has brought them there, and God has equipped them to do this kind of work, and so that God honors that kind of work. So I think a Lutheran theology really avoids some of the problems and even some of the fears that some have about Christianity being misused to take away learning and to take away even academic freedom. Again, I think as Lutherans, we have a big advantage in that. And Lutheran institutions have a big advantage in that, too.
Dr. Philip, any thoughts about misunderstandings about academic freedom, especially in our culture in the United States? Are there misunderstandings about what is academic freedom and how far it should go?
Yeah, I think there are. I think there's the misconception of that Dr. Veith was talking about in terms of an understanding that a Christian college or a college from a particular theological perspective, not necessarily even a Christian school. I think those who would mm-hmm. be concerned about religious institutions would have similar concerns, say, for a Jewish institution or an institution connected to some other type of religious entity, that those guidelines or those doctrines that may be mm-hmm. in place, those confessional subscription type statements that might need to be signed by faculty, that limits their ability to engage in research and discussion beyond only that set of things. And that certainly is, it's important to clarify that that's not the case, that just because an institution has an underlying faith system that is forming what its belief system is, it doesn't mean that mm-hmm. that institution is not interested in discovering things about the world around them. It certainly is. I think another important misconception that is often out there is sort of the flip side of that, is that an institution that isn't somehow connected to a religious entity has a wide open academic freedom, and that there aren't any things that are informing what their worldview might be or restricting the mm-hmm. kinds of things that they might be doing research on or teaching in their classrooms. So, for example, it's important to understand that a public institution, whether that's a state-run institution or whether it's a private institution that has no affiliation with mm-hmm. any particular religious entity, those institutions also have sets of regulations that govern what they're doing and that have the same kinds of capacity to put restrictions on just how far academic freedom may go. So it's important to keep in mind that those who would be concerned about what sort of restrictions might be placed upon academic freedom not only be considering that for a religious institution, but that they recognize that government-run institutions would have similar kinds of things that might inform what academic freedom looks like there and what they're able to do.
Everybody
yeah,
has.
Let me. I've got to give some examples. Secularist institutions, too, academic freedom can be a big issue. And it's not necessarily, official statements, but it's sort of a cultural one. For example, there are a lot of university faculties. If you faculty members who maybe start questioning Darwin's theory of evolution, they wouldn't dare go public with that mm-hmm. because they know in their profession they would be just crushed. Those who question in some places if they were to articulate a conservative or Republican political opinion, they would be ostracized and find it very, very dangerous in their career to say something that isn't, this is where we get the word politically correct. The idea that, and that came out of colleges too, that there's a certain kind of political ideology mm-hmm. that you have to uphold, and that you're really, and if you're not politically correct, if you violate that ideology in any way, you can get in big trouble. And so a scholar who questions feminism or the gay rights agenda or evolution or global warming or a lot of these issues today are facing incredible hostility by their colleagues, and their academic freedom is not always respected, as by the principals of the university it really needs to be.
Mm-hmm. Sure, they don't. Everybody has a worldview, and every institution has a culture, and that culture it apparently shapes that academic freedom at in institutions. We need to take a quick break. When we come back from the break, I want to talk about an article in the recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education. We'll do that as we're talking with our guests, Reverend Dr. Paul Philp, Director of Institutional Integrity and Research at Concordia University System, and Dr. Jean Veith, Provost at Patrick Henry College. Stick around for more Faith and Family right after this on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of Inspiration in Action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
William Rashbaum was an abortionist in New York City. It's estimated he did over 20,000 abortions during his career of more than 30 years. Mother Jones Magazine called him one of the preeminent and longest practicing abortionists of second trimester abortions in the United States. During an interview, he let his guard down and admitted to a recurring nightmare. In it, he would see an unborn baby desperately trying to hold onto the wall of the uterus by her tiny fingernails as he did the abortion. Rashbaum kept doing abortions until his failing health forced him to stop. Sadly, there's no indication of a repentant heart before he died. It's too late for him, but it's not for all the other abortionists. We can and should be praying for their change of hearts.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.
Babies are born with very small amounts of vitamin K, a vital nutrient their bodies need for blood to clot. Vitamin K deficiency bleeding, or VKDB, is a condition that occurs when a baby doesn't have enough vitamin K. The good news is, just one dose protects your baby from dangerous bleeding. The American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended vitamin K for all newborns since 1961. Don't take a chance. Plan for your baby to receive the recommended dose.
A message from the Missouri Department of Health and Senior Services.
Hi, this is Vern Gunderman inviting you and your golf buddies to participate in Christian Friends of New America's second annual golf tournament. It's Wednesday, October 1st, at Quail Creek Golf Course. Funds raised help CFNA welcome refugees and new Americans in the name of Jesus Christ, as CFNA helps them establish a new life through Bible studies, tutoring, health screenings, citizenship, and ESL classes. It also provides scholarships so they can attend LCMS schools. Please join us. Information at cfna-stl.org.
Reverend Dr. Matthew C. Harrison of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod recently said these words regarding the importance of the work of Concordia Historical Institute.
When you forget your past, you forget the gospel. You become locked into your own little part of time. As you study the past and know the past and know what happened in the past, you see God at work. And you see Christ.
Discover your Lutheran history at ConcordiaHistoricalInstitute.org.
Hi, I'm Andy Bates. I invite you to join me weekdays at 10 a.m. for Faith and Family. where we talk with experts and everyday people about topics pertinent to faithful family life. Weekdays at 10 a.m. on Worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news, underwritten by Concordia University, Wisconsin. Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm your host, Andy Bates. We are talking about academic freedom and religious freedom today with Dr. Gene Veith, Provost at Patrick Henry College, and Reverend Dr. Paul Philip, Director of Institutional Integrity and Research for the Concordia University System. Before we went to break, we were talking about what is academic freedom, some misunderstandings or misconceptions about academic freedom. And I think we've painted a clear picture here that academic freedom is important in order for colleges, for institutions of higher education to be places of not only teaching, but also study and research, so that we can investigation, so that we can continue to learn and investigate the world around us. Having the freedom to do that is important. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we do that outside of the scope of what we believe, teach, and confess. Recently, Professor Peter Kahn, he's a professor at professor of English. There you go, Dr. Veith, is professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania. What? Not how far from you? Probably not too far, huh?
No, not really.
He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Wrote an article for the Chronicle of Higher Education entitled "The Great Accreditation Farce." And Dr. Philip, you and I have talked about accreditation before and the importance of accreditation. Professor Kahn is critical of religious colleges, particularly those who require their faculty to sign a faith statement. He objects to accreditation of these institutions because such practices limit academic freedom, saying, quote, "Academic freedom must submit to God in a Christian college." That was what he was quoted saying in the New York Times. What are your thoughts on that last statement? Your thoughts on, Christian colleges saying academic freedom must to submit to God in a Christian college? Dr. Philip?
Well, I think in a certain sense that, the statement itself on face value is true. indeed, whatever we do and in our lives as we live out our life is ultimately in submission to God, whether we want to acknowledge that or not, or whether we realize that or not. Mm-hmm. The point, though, that I think that he's making goes beyond certainly that level, and he's trying to suggest that somebody is defining by using God as their authority what exactly can be looked at, what can be taught, what can be researched, and so forth, and that as such, there's a great limitation placed upon those faculty and the students, really, too, who are at those institutions and what they're able to study. And he's suggesting that really ultimately violates what the accrediting agencies are looking for in terms of academic freedom and encouraging all of the types of things that we were talking about in the portion of the show before the break. What the challenge is that he really has made that statement with really somewhat of a false understanding. I think in a certain sense that that statement of faith gives those faculty, in a real way, almost more freedom to research because they've said, here's what we agree that we believe, teach, and confess, but that gives me the ability to go out and look at these other things and to research what's being taught in those areas, to discover what new things may be out there, and to be able to share them because I've said, hey, just be, I believe this over here, so that gives me some room to work over on the other side of the equation, in a sense of looking at things and investigating and comparing and contrasting various teachings and those sorts of things, ultimately with the understanding that whatever I'm going to discover through my research is part of the world that's been created. Now, the interesting thing about that is the contrasting point of that is when someone is at an institution that doesn't have something like that, perhaps a state school, for example, and we alluded to this a little bit before the break, there may not be a statement that they sign that says, I agree that I'm going to conduct myself according to this particular ideology or something of that nature, but there's certainly a very strong unwritten expectation that is going to happen, so much so that they really can't begin to step beyond that sort of box that they've been put in and conduct their research and their investigation, or at least talk about it afterwards. And consequently, in a certain sense, they're the ones who are really having to submit to something, not submitting to God, as the author of the article is quoted as saying there, but submitting to an authority that's telling them what they can and can't do, and in a certain sense, really limiting their academic freedom if they want to continue to have a future in the world of higher ed.
Yeah, Dr. V.
Statements of faith are used in hiring faculty when you want to bring faculty together who share a common faith, a common theology, a common worldview. The statement of faith is not used to then police what the faculty are doing. Now, in my case, for example, I taught at a state school before I joined the faculty at Concordia Mequon many years ago. One of my academic interests is the relationship between Christianity and literature, Christianity and the arts. Now, when I was teaching at a state school, I did not feel free to really talk about things and to follow things through with my students that I wanted to in those areas, because it's a state institution, you're not allowed to have the establishment of religion, so you have to be really careful about how you talk about religious things. When I came to Concordia, I had more academic freedom than I did when I was in a state school. The reason was because my commitments and my interests are in the spiritual questions and how they relate to literature and the arts. And so I had more academic freedom than before. Now, the irony in that essay, I mean, who is it that is telling people that they cannot think certain things or they cannot believe certain things? Professor Kahn is the one who's doing that, not a religious person. He's saying that Christian colleges basically should not be allowed to exist, because if they're not accredited in many states, they can't stay in operation. He's saying that a Christian college, a school that's committed to religion, and the faculty members who voluntarily agree together and are part of that church or that tradition, are not allowed to be part of the academic community. That is overtly violating academic freedom. It's preventing the freedom of those who hold those positions. And the sort of incoherence of that article is almost comical, because in the name of academic freedom, he's demanding that certain ideas be stamped out of the academy.
Mm-hmm. He says near the in the second to last paragraph, let me be clear, I have no particular objection to like-minded adherents of one or another religion banding together, calling their association a college, and charging students for the privilege of having their religious beliefs affirmed. However, I have a profound objection to legitimizing such an association through accreditation and thereby conceding that the integrity of scholarship and teaching is merely negotiable.
Well, first of all, he doesn't know what accreditation even involves. Accreditation involves looking at what your students have learned. It involves student outcomes. It doesn't look at, well, what's the assumption of your school? He has this assumption that higher education is about skepticism. Where does he get that? Where does that come from? Historically, his own school was founded by Benjamin Franklin, but the other founder of it was George Whitefield, who was an evangelist of the First Great Awakening. Almost every college in this country and around the world had its origins in the church. It was the church that invented universities. But anyway, his attempt to sort of deny that the whole heritage is again, shows a great, great ignorance. But the other thing of it is accreditation looks at, again, outcomes. Different schools have different philosophies, not just Christian, not just secularists. There are all kinds of different ranges. What the accreditors do is look at, are your students learning? Are your students getting a good education from this experience? He picks on Wheaton College, which is probably one of the most academically rigorous and effective schools in the whole country, certainly among Christian colleges. I taught at Wheaton as a visiting professor one semester, and I've never found a school, actually, Patrick Henry now, I think, is almost aspires to that same level, a very strong academics, very bright students, a strong commitment to learning. And I think if he'd find some objective measurement, he claims to think science is the only measure. I would love for him to look at Wheaton's test scores or whatever measure they have. That's the thing that the accreditors look at. Why he thinks they did not deserve to be accredited when they outperform, I think, most regular schools just in their own terms.
Well, he actually served on the accreditation team. He led the self-study that preceded the University of Pennsylvania's accreditation visit in 2003 and was a member of the team that visited Johns Hopkins in 2004.
Those are schools of the same, mm-hmm. of the same
right.
ilk. Now, what this is a symptom of is a real problem in higher education today. And it's not just, Christians or conservatives, complaining about things. There's a book out called Academically Adrift, subtitled The Lack of Learning in Higher Education, by a University of Chicago scholar, who's found that what a student will learn in colleges today is less than what they learned even just a few years ago. And in things like critical thinking and things that colleges are emphasizing, some students come out worse at critical thinking than when they came in. And this is at some of the mainline schools. And so there's a lot of kind of dysfunction in higher education. And we see just this bigotry against anything religious that comes out of that article. It really demonstrates a kind of narrow-minded and just incorrect view about accreditation and about higher education today, and that desire to stamp out religious schools is just sheer prejudice.
When Professor Khan questioned the accrediting organization, the North Central Association of Colleges and Schools, he wasn't satisfied with the association's response about Wheaton's accreditation. The response he received, federal regulations and commission policies require that the commission respect a wide range of institutional missions and belief systems in its accrediting process. He describes that as a scandal. Is it truly scandalous to respect belief systems in this postmodern and pluralistic culture?
Another word for that would be academic freedom. Now he's against it.
Yeah, I would say that the scandal there is his perspective of suggesting that those systems should not be respected. precisely because if you go down the path of his argumentation, you would drastically limit the academic freedom and academic inquiry in many areas.
Including his own.
Including his own.
And that's the real funny thing. If you're in a field like mine, I'm in English too, like he is. He said that, well, religious schools don't follow reason as the main criterion. Now, I would wager that Wheaton College and Concordia Colleges and Patrick Henry College, that we actually probably honor reason more, certainly, than I suspect happens in the typical, you know, Ivy League or state English department. In our field, in English, this is where postmodernism, this is the where postmodernism is at its highest pitch, and part of postmodernism is the rejection of reason and logic and objectivity and any kind of objective meaning. The idea is there is no objective truth. We create our own truths. Now, whatever you think about that, that is not upholding the canons of reason that he's saying schools have to. I mean, I would like to look at his own field, his own discipline, his own department, and see if how that comes up by that criteria. And I think you would find that religious schools probably do more with reason than is happening at least a lot of the classrooms at the University of Pennsylvania.
He, in the close of his article, he says, by effectively endorsing such blinkered sentiments through its accreditation process, American higher education is betraying itself and providing aid and comfort to those who would replace reason with theology. It's as if he's creating a dichotomy between reason and theology, that he's pitting reason against theology here.
Right, which theologians and the Christian tradition doesn't do. They're two different things with two different realms and mustn't always be confused with each other. But again, it's the theologians who there's this Father Brown mystery. Father Brown solves the problem. He identifies somebody pretending to be a priest because he's attacking reason. He said no real Christian priest would do that. And so obviously Professor Kahn doesn't know anything about theology.
It's almost as though he makes the assumption that the theology department at a religious institution is driving anything and everything that's taking place on that institution's campus as well, and that certainly isn't the case either. And certainly within the classrooms where theology is the topic that or area that's being taught, theology's in the driver's seat. That doesn't mean that in a wide variety of other disciplines, those things aren't being taught. And there's an overarching rule of theology, as it were, and the same would be true on his campus. I'm sure there's probably no one department that's carrying its discipline over to everything else. But if you go with his argumentation, that's basically the point that he comes at, that reason's just completely set aside. Theology is king, as it were. And then he makes assumptions about what that theology happens to be. And those assumptions aren't necessarily correct either.
And what that theology dictates.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think having a Christian worldview, having a theological convictions and commitments, can help a scholar, especially in this time of postmodernism, because I think the real anti-intellectualism comes from postmodernism. Because if there's no truth, what is there to study? What is there to research? What is there to teach? And if everybody is just making up their own truths and one idea is as good as another, to me that's a formula for academic collapse. That's a formula for the end of knowledge. And one thing Christianity has always given universities and the whole Western intellectual tradition is the conviction that there really is truth, that it can be known, that there's an order in the universe and a meaning in the universe. We might not know everything about it, and we might not understand it completely, but there is something that can inspire the academic enterprise. And I think for Christian scholars, that's the function Christianity gives. And so it actually frees and liberates someone who hungers and thirsts after knowledge of any kind. And so Christian institutions and Christian scholars really can have a really important part to play, and even an advantage to learning and scholarship that a lot of the secularists have sort of thrown away.
And that there, it's almost as if there's this misunderstanding that there is no place for reason in a Christian institution. Is almost what I hear him saying, that there's no place for reason, that you have this very narrow theology and there's no place for reason whatsoever in a Christian college.
Yeah.
Yep, that
and
seems
again, the Lutheran Two Kingdoms view sees reason is how we learn in God's kingdom of the left hand, in God's spiritual kingdom. That's the realm of revelation of what God reveals to us in His Word. And so that's a source of knowledge, especially in the spiritual domain. And then as we learn about the world, then for that we use reason. Now, again, it's easy to get those mixed up. And, that can be done on either side. But again, I think Lutheran theology can really help us to sort out a lot of these issues.
We've got just about a minute and a half to 2 minutes left. The importance of academic freedom, accreditation, religious freedom, all of this is a discussion that I think every student needs to consider. Yeah. When they're making their choices about college, as they're preparing for the future, or if they're planning on going to college after high school, this is something that they need to consider to have these conversations with faculty. To when you have a chance to visit a college, talk with the faculty about what does academic freedom mean to them. What does it mean that if it's a Christian college, what does it mean for them to be on the faculty at a Christian college? What does it mean for them? I think those are important things to consider. With about 30 seconds, Pastor Philip, any final thoughts today as we wrap up our time?
Well, I would agree. Those are key pieces that that a student and their parents should be considering as they're looking at the college that they may wish to attend and comparing and contrasting. Be aware of what those restrictions or what those non-restrictions might be. How is academic freedom practiced? What does it mean, as you say, for the faculty member to be serving on a Christian campus or on a non-Christian campus? And how do they look at those things so that you can consider a college that fits within the nature of education that you would like to enter into, and you have an understanding of what you're going to be getting when you set foot on that campus and begin to study there and begin to learn from those faculty members, so that you are making a choice that you think is going to be the best fit for you and for your family.
Yeah, and I would add, why do Christians go and spend their money on a college that is so contemptuous of their deepest beliefs? I just don't understand that.
Absolutely. We've been talking with the Reverend Dr. Paul Philip, Director of Institutional Integrity and Research for the Concordia University System. Dr. Philip, thanks for being our guest today on Faith and Family.
Thank you. My privilege.
And Dr. Gene Veith, Provost at Patrick Henry College. Dr. Veith, great to talk with you again. Thanks for being our guest today.
Well, my pleasure.
It was a lot of fun to get to talk about academic freedom. I had the freedom to do that, so that was nice. Coming up in just a little bit, we've got Thy Strong Word with Pastor Whedon, so you get to study God's Word. Stick around for more great programming right here on listener-supported worldwide KFUO, the messenger of good news.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.